Ice Ice Baby. On a recent rainy Saturday morning at around 11:20, I found myself inside the Los Angeles Sports Arena in Exposition Park, sitting 13 feet away from a girl wearing ice skates, a bare midriff, and a mermaid tail. I was choking back the tears and biting my lower lip to keep it from quivering the same way that one might close his eyes to stop the day from dawning, but it was no use. The sentimentality of the moment was way too much for me. Just 20 minutes earlier, Tinkerbell had hit the ice with the grace of a goalie, having just thrown off the gloves, her torso as thick as a stack of tires, her swinging fists the size of pot roasts. Her appearance was baffling to both my 4-year-old twin daughters, whose concept of the famous Disney fairy had been that of a spirited pixie as lilting as a 9-ounce 60-watt asterisk, but here now was what looked like Bill Shatner in a wig and a green sequined mini-dress. His polyurethane pantyhose pulled hard over hockey skates, his neck swallowed, like his pride, by middle age. Immediately I worried that the fairy tale magic that my wife and I had promised to our children might not come to pass, and this pissed me off. After all, the title of the program was Disney on Ice Presents Princess Wishes, and unless all the princesses were due to suddenly appear and to link hands and to wish aloud for a normal-sized pituitary gland for the Neanderthal currently charging around the ice like a baboon, I was ready to ask for my money back. Or, more precisely, I was ready to ask for my wife's money back. I had to admit that I myself would never have wasted my money on anything as sexist and redundant and maniacally optimistic as a Disney production called Princess Wishes. Howard Zinn on ice, yes. Karen Finley and the Baloney Zamboni, definitely. But Princess Wishes? All I can say is that it was a Christmas present that my daughters and me found in our stockings a month earlier. It was the kind of Christmas present that had me hating the baby Jesus all over again, and looking forward to Easter when he would get what was coming to him. "That's a big Tinkerbell," I leaned over and whispered into the ear of the twin sitting to my left. "Yeah," she said, her brow furrowed like she was trying to decipher Sanskrit, her eyes locked on the behemoth pumping her gargantuan thighs around the rink. I then started to wonder if this wasn't one of those rare teachable moments that a parent was obligated to recognize and then to seize with both hands. After all, wasn't a remarkably telling reality trumping a rather abusive fantasy on the ice right in front of me? Wasn't this Tinkerbell, by being the stark opposite of the mega-petite, super-unrealistic body type that defined the animated version, someone to be revered and not criticized? I thought of the agony that many parents are made to suffer as helpless bystanders forced to watch their daughters develop eating disorders in an attempt to approximate a Barbie doll thinness that the mere existence of bulky internal organs makes impossible. Of course, to come anywhere close to approximating the body type of the slugger galloping around before us, my daughters would have to learn how to unhinge their jawbones and to grow a second stomach capable of digesting hoof, bone, and fur. Nevertheless, I felt that I had a responsibility as a father to be a truth commentator rather than a complacent apologist for the brutal commodification and starvation of girls everywhere. Feeling a certain satisfaction that the day might turn out not to be a complete waste of time, I leaned back down towards the same twin, same ear, to tell her that a 7-foot Tinkerbell with an Adam's apple and an equine lather was both normal and beautiful, but was interrupted by an explosion of applause celebrating the appearance of Aladdin and Princess Jasmine. Both were practically nude by Disney standards, meaning that I could see their navels, their armpits, the dimpled smalls of their soon-to-be glistening backs, Aladdin's nipples, Jasmine's shoulder blades. Plus, they were in baggy pajamas. Pajamas that, when blown against their bodies, became megaphones for the shape and contour of their parts and services. Immediately preoccupied with the details of a completely invented backstory involving these two, I forgot about correcting my daughter's assumed misinterpretation of what was going on, and I concentrated on my own lurid misreading of the situation. First, I imagined that Aladdin and Jasmine were really in love with each other, passionately, and not merely actors hired to feign affection. I had them groping each other after every performance, his little red fez being pushed off by her knees, her head thrown back in ecstasy as her baby blue brassiere, festooned with plastic gems and gold lamé trim, is rolled up roughly into a twisted annoyance below her chin. "Popcorn?" said a sweet buttercup of a voice next to me in the dark. "Hang on a second," I said, ignoring the tugging on my forearm. "Daddy's trying to listen to the words." Ironically, with the appearance of each Disney princess into the spotlight, each a virgin yearning for true love and getting it right between the eyes by a square-jawed Disney prince, the debauchery that I was imagining slowly gave way to an attention to the song lyrics they were lip-syncing while flamboyantly overacting, In no time at all, not only had I convinced myself that Aladdin and Jasmine were so perfectly matched, both physically and spiritually, I'd also found myself forgiving the thinly veiled racism personified by the prosthetically hook-nosed Arabs chasing the couple around the ice, along with the missed jumps and falls of the entire troop. Well aware that I was demonstrating the same exact brand of willful ignorance practiced by the supporters of every politician who's ever been elected on the cruel and empty promise of a fairy tale, I decided not to care. Slippery ice was slippery ice, whether it gave Snow White all that she needed to express the exquisite grace of her woodland horniness, or it made Barack Obama and his political credibility fall down and get up, fall down, get up, fall down, get up. For the sheer spectacle of the fantasy, I was perfectly willing to hate myself in the morning. I was willing to believe. In no time at all, I was sniffling and wiping my nose with my palm, wanting more than anything else in the world for Ariel to get the human leg she so coveted and to walk with Prince Eric into the soapy Christian goodness of the rest of their lives, scentless and as gleeful as freshly minted coins. This, I figured, is what I got for having no church to go to, or any belief in even a smidgen of the optimistic boulder dash of any political person, party, or platform. I was like a gynecologist who suddenly had his speculum and flashlight confiscated and replaced with a lava lamp and a Barry White 8-track. My analytical understanding of what was unfolding directly in front of me as impossible to conjure as the words water, mucin, lipids, lysozyme, lactoferrin, lipocalin, lacritin, immunoglobulins, glucose, urea, sodium, and potassium to describe the substance dribbling from my tear ducts. And then the world blew up, and regretfully, it was beautiful.